Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, January 20th, 2011, marks the 50th anniversary of the inauguration of John F. Kennedy, and as our guest says, one of the most memorable and powerful speeches ever delivered by a U.S. president, his inaugural address. Also, this week, 50 years ago, January 17th, Dwight Eisenhower delivered, as our guest says, we have two guests this hour, what has become, with the possible exception of George Washington's departing speech, the best-known presidential farewell address in U.S. history, in which he warned against unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. We'll look at both of these speeches this hour of the program with two engaging guests and knowledgeable guests, and welcome your phone calls. Some of you will have been alive to hear both of these addresses, and others will be interested in learning about these addresses and adding to your knowledge about them. Our phone number for the entire hour is 800-486-8655, and you can't talk about these masterpieces without hearing some of them, a portion now of President John Kennedy's inauguration address.
Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world.
Thurston Clark is one of our guests, historian, author, and journalist, author of Ask Not, The Inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. He's written a number of other books, including Pearl Harbor Ghosts, The Legacy of December 7, 1941. Ask Not is out in paperback, and it is a fascinating look at who the president was, the fact that he was an avid reader of history and collected quotations as his mother did. It looks at his influences on his mind and what he wanted to say and who gave him advice and what was going on with everybody in his family and with him during the weeks before the inauguration is found in the book, Ask Not. Thurston, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And you on this day were in, you were at a boarding school and you were in the infirmary when you heard this address.
That's correct, yes. I was there with two of the more fearsome people in that school. One was the school nurse and the other was a Latin master. But as the speech unfolded, both of them began to cry. I saw tears on their cheeks, and I later realized, of course, these were the two people in the school who'd had the hardest wartime experiences. The nurse had treated terrible burn cases in Nova Scotia, and the Latin master had fought in the Pacific, horrific battles, Guadalcanal, and throughout the Pacific War.
Mm-hmm. I love the book because it weaves together the essence of who this president was, that which he did very well, his masterpieces and also his foibles, but the influences on him, how smart he was, his knowledge of history, and all that was going on with all of these fascinating figures in the weeks before the inauguration, his family, his wife, his children, his father, his mother, and others. It's he had a lot of things going on in his mind and physically, right?
Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, you've gotten to the heart of the thing earlier about this speech was very much about him and his experiences. I call it in some ways, it's kind of a rhetorical autobiography, particularly at the beginning of the speech when he talks about the torch being passed to a generation born in this century, him, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace. Well, he was talking about himself as well as his generation, of course.
Yes, I love that part of the speech. It just sets the moment and it passes to a new generation. Mm-hmm. Let's bring in David Greenberg, professor of history and journalism at Media Studies at Rutgers University, author of Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image, Calvin Coolidge and Presidential Doodles. David, thank you very much for being with us as well.
I'm glad to be with you.
And it was only a couple days before this, we very dramatically have these two presidents and Eisenhower giving an address that we have analyzed also for the past 50 years. He of the generation of heroes who led the war effort and was a hero in America's eyes. Tell me about the fact that he gives the address and then we have Kennedy just a couple days later giving the inaugural. What are we witnessing here? What kind of transition?
Well, it's a transition of many kinds, one from a conservative, much more passive president to a liberal activist president, one from a military man to a man who had served in the military, as Kennedy had, but you know, did not make that his career-long identity, and one of generation, as Thurston said, that you know, Eisenhower very much embodied an older era, an older America. And toward the end of his presidency, there was a sense of drift, a sense of torpor and complacency in America, and an anxiety flowing from that. Part of Kennedy's genius was to replace that in kind of the whole national mood changed to one of excitement and dynamism, a sense that America could do great things again. That sense had really atrophied toward the end of the Eisenhower administration.
Mm-hmm. Why is it, do you think, Thurston, that we remember, and we remember in terms of the rhetoric and the way that it really got your heart, the Kennedy speech probably more, which was a masterful speech. Why do we remember and analyze these 50 years later?
Well, the Kennedy speech, first of all, was immediately hailed as a speech for the ages, as a masterpiece, not just by the Democrats, but by Republicans as well. Barry Goldwater praised it, saying, God, I'd like to be able to do what that boy did there.
What that boy did.
Putting him down. But really, the Hearst newspapers, even the people had been very hostile to Kennedy, and remember, it had been a very close election, very close popular vote, praised this speech. So it was instantly recognized as a classic, and it is held up over time, in part because there's been no inaugural address that has equaled it since. There's been nothing to diminish its luster. I mean, probably Reagan's first is the best inaugural address since Kennedy's, but at the end of the century, when a group of historians and professors of rhetoric got together to rank the great speeches, the American speeches of the 20th century, Kennedy came in second after Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream. So this is a speech that is held, that was not only hailed, but is also held up. I like to think that when we were talking about the torch being passed, I think definitely this sense of moving away from this kind of post-Sputnik pessimism. Don't forget, we were terribly worried the Russians were ahead of us because of Sputnik, into this kind of moonshot optimism that Kennedy brings in. I like to think that the inauguration, it reminds me of that moment in The Wizard of Oz, when we suddenly go from black and white to color. Well, on January 20th, this nation suddenly went in a way from black and white to color, from Eisenhower, the gray, the suit, the men in the gray flannel suits, to Kennedy. Hmm. Quite a change.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that description, David?
I do, and I think if you look at Eisenhower's speech, which I actually watched the other night as part of an event commemorating that, you know, his delivery, he's not much of an orator, so his delivery is sort of plain. It was shown in black and white. You know, there was no color footage, I don't believe, of certainly on television, and it appeared in black and white. I think there is color footage of the Kennedy inaugural, if my memory is correct. So that's literally kind of true, going from black and white to color. The other night, there were a number of Washington pundits on the stage who were trying to make the argument that Eisenhower's was the wiser speech because it was notes of caution as opposed to Kennedy's idealism. And although I suppose there's some truth in that, I think that judgment is also a reflection of our current moment, when we have a lot of anxiety about the projection of American power in the world under Bush and continuing under Obama, that has made a lot of people uneasy. But in a way, misreads both speeches. Eisenhower's speech was not an anti-war manifesto, as it is sometimes remembered these days. And Kennedy's speech was not Cold War bang the drums. I mean, there was a lot of rhetoric about the twilight struggle, but there was also rhetoric about negotiation, about cooperation. This was not saber-rattling on Kennedy's part. It was the ultimate note was one of working toward peace, working toward a better world.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't agree more with what they just said. I mean, he's absolutely right on. I would just mention that the press at the time, right now, people like to remember Pay Any Price, Bear Any Burden, and talk about this as a saber-rattling Cold War speech. Actually, the newspapers at the time saw it as a peace speech. And the headlines in the newspaper, San Francisco, Kennedy sworn in asks Grand Alliance for Peace, Washington Post, New Quest for Peace, Herald Tribune, Kennedy asks World Peace Quest, and so on and so on. And also Eisenhower's speech the day before, 2 days later, when he got together with Kennedy the day before the inauguration, he warned him that he was going to have to go to war in Laos. And scared Kennedy and his advisors, and told them that he thought they were going to have to put a combat division to enter Laos. So anyway, I think that that's absolutely right. Speeches.
And when you look at the mission that he had to accomplish, here you have, in a matter of a couple days, a war hero, Dwight Eisenhower, who's given his farewell address, and we'll talk more about the military-industrial complex, and a very young 43-year-old president who also has been a war hero, but not like Eisenhower has. So he has to, as Goldwater called him, that boy, he had to establish himself very much as a man and as a leader of the free world.
Yeah, absolutely. And this speech, of course, was he saw this as this opportunity. It was tremendously important for him because, of course, he was the first Catholic president as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd won by such a narrow margin in the popular vote. There was a lot riding on this speech for Kennedy, in addition to the fact that he was, like all the Kennedys, very competitive. And he wanted to give the best inaugural address in history. I mean, he wanted nothing less. He told Sorensen to go and study the Gettysburg Address so he could learn his secrets. When he had Robert Frost invited him to give a poem, he made sure that Frost wouldn't compose a new poem, that Kennedy could pick the poem because he didn't want to be upstaged by some marvelous piece of poetry that Frost would write for the occasion. This was planned.
In Eisenhower's speech, do we know what Kennedy thought of that speech, David?
You know, that's interesting. I don't. I haven't looked at what Kennedy's reaction was. There probably are Kennedy biographers who could answer that question. Certainly the two men shared certain attitudes, and so for all the differences that I drew earlier, I mean, both men were clearly internationalists. Eisenhower was significant because he turned the Republican Party from an isolationist party into an internationalist or interventionist party when he defeated Robert Taft for the 1952 Republican presidential nomination. That was a sign that the party was moving toward a new direction. And remember, these days we think of the Republicans as the party that's kind of more interested in projecting American influence around the world. But in those days, it was Franklin Roosevelt who really, had that reputation, and the Democrats. And so it was significant that Eisenhower brought the Republicans in that direction. And Kennedy certainly shared that. But they also both shared a kind of suspicion of the military's growing tendency to kind of try to dominate political affairs and foreign policy. Remember, this is the era of movies like 7 Days in May, where there are these fears of military coups. It was a time when, obviously, as Eisenhower says, military power is growing. The Cold War is sort of requiring this buildup of our kind of permanent defense structure. And Eisenhower and Kennedy both were sort of firmly determined not to take their marching orders from the Pentagon. I mean, if you look at Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, he's kind of fighting back against people like Curtis LeMay, who want to take a much more aggressive and extreme approach. So there are real kind of continuities in that resistance to kind of military domination of civilian policymaking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I could just jump in, the 7 days in May thing is interesting. I'm researching a book I'm doing now about John F. Kennedy, the last 100 days of his administration. And I've come up with several times when he kind of jokes, but kind of isn't joking, about 7 days in May, about whether it could happen to him, particularly around the time that he was trying to get support for the limited test ban treaty. But even before that, you know, he arranged for John Frankenheimer to be able to film 7 days in May at the White House. The Pentagon wouldn't let Frankenheimer film there. So Kennedy, kind of on the sly, said to Frankenheimer that he could film in front of the White House and arranged to be away in Hyannis when Frankenheimer was filming. There are several of the tapes that Kennedy recorded. He refers to 7 days in May scenario, somewhat jokingly, but sometimes not, about whether it could happen to him. And he definitely felt that he had one strike with the Bay of Pigs, when he didn't allow the U.S. to use force to support the Cubans on the beaches there who were fighting against Castro. And then again in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when LeMay and the others were very bitter, they wanted to immediately go in and bomb the Russian sites. So he was sensitive to this, and it was a time when there was a great pushback in the military. And the military did not like Kennedy at all, and the Joint Chiefs didn't either.
Tell me about this day, Thurston, what time he woke up. You may have to include where he was the night before, the bath that he took, how he chose his clothes, all of those acts are just fascinating, and they were all purposeful.
Yes, they are. He was again and again reading and rereading the speech, trying to memorize portions of it. We have to remember in those days that he didn't have the kind of teleprompters, the aides that politicians have now, that he had the speech printed in large print on paper in a loose leaf binder. And as he read it over, he saw apparently changes he wanted to make, or some changes, and he wouldn't write. He didn't want to write on the reading copy of the speech because he considered it an important historical document. So what he did was he kind of thought about those things, and when he delivered the speech, he made 32 extemporaneous changes to the text. And in fact, you have to be a bit cautious sometimes now, still now, in the internet. If you pull up, for example, Ask Not, you get Ask Not What Your Country Will Do For You instead of Can Do For You. Because that's one of the changes that Kennedy made.
Huh.
But it was, again, there's some kind of hilarious moments ago, and he discovers that the collar, his formal collar, won't fit around his neck because he's gained so much weight during the campaign. Kennedy was a very vain man, and carried a scale with him everywhere. He thought his hair was his greatest feature. He was constantly brushing and combing it. When he went on campaign in an open car, he would be careful not to comb it unless he was in a tunnel or underpass, because he never wanted the press to catch him. So there was, all of this was going on, but he was preparing himself not just for the speech, but also for the visual impact that he wanted to make. So, of course, he wore long underwear so he could appear without a coat, unlike Eisenhower and the rest of them.
We are going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. Within the course of a week, two very famous American speeches, and we're looking at them because we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of both. On January 17, 50 years ago, Dwight Eisenhower, his military-industrial complex farewell address, and, of course, John Kennedy's inaugural address, which was today, 50 years ago. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our guests are Thurston Clark, historian. His book, apropos to this conversation, is really fascinating. Ask Not, the inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the speech that changed America. He, as you heard him say, is also working right now on a book of the last 100 days of the Kennedy administration. David Greenberg, professor of history and journalism and media studies at Rutgers University, author of Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image, Calvin Coolidge, and Presidential Doodles. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We'll take some of your calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
President Dwight Eisenhower, in his farewell address 50 years ago on January 17, is part of the reason that we examine this so much and bring it up so often is that we worry about the unwarranted influence of not only military contractors, but people in the healthcare field and people in Wall Street, that it's just expanded, and so it is worthy of our attention, or is it something else, David?
Well, I think part of it is that, I mean, I certainly agree there's, we have a hugely wasteful Pentagon budget that, you know, the Secretary Gates, to his credit, is making some effort, I think, now to try to prune back. But the speech has always gotten a new life from wars that begin with public approval and then become unpopular. Vietnam and then, of course, Iraq. And there is, I think, a wish on the part of the public to kind of absolve itself, at least on some people in the public, to absolve ourselves from at least those people who did lend support to the war, and to say we were led into it under false pretenses. You know, so we have this with the intelligence stuff, and there's also a kind of wish to say there was a power much bigger than democracy, and it's in the big bad military-industrial complex. It's a kind of conspiratorial view of history. And it kind of gets causation backwards. The reason we have such a large military-industrial complex is because we generally believe, obviously not all people, but we generally believe that America should play a leading role in the world, and that that often comes with a military role. That's controversial, but it's generally supported by the public. It is Congress and the president who sort of together allow these military budgets to grow because it is public opinion in large part that they're fearful of if they start being portrayed as cutting into Pentagon budgets. So on the one hand, the military-industrial complex is kind of seen, as Eisenhower said it was, as necessary for the Cold War age and the post-Cold War age, with America playing a superpower role. On the other hand, it's a kind of convenient scapegoat because it can be saddled with the burdens of leading us into war. Now, I think the speech was important, and I think the criticisms of the military-industrial complex, I don't want anyone to misunderstand me, are quite on point that Eisenhower made. And he was right to warn against its influence, to warn against these overblown budgets, which, of course, can divert our resources from needed domestic and other causes. But it's wrong when it gets into a conspiracy theory that it's the arms makers who are taking us into war, which is an old idea that goes back to World War I.
Mm-hmm. And the Kennedy inaugural addressing both of them, Kennedy's, and it received some criticism for this, addressing the role of America in the world, Thurston,
yeah,
when he's talking about Well, he says a lot about this. A lot of it is foreign policy. Most of this address is foreign policy.
Most of it is, indeed. It's all about the relations with the Soviet Union, and it's about the threat of nuclear war. He refers in different times in different ways to the atom bomb. He talks about the dark powers of destruction, the spread of the deadly atom. And then he talks about man holding in his mortal hands the power to end all human life. And so there's all of this this business about the dangers of war and the dangers. You see, Kennedy realized that Kennedy wanted to be a great president. I mean, on the ambition scale, rather than the accomplishment scale, he's way up there. But he realized that you couldn't be a great wartime president anymore, that it was impossible because the war with the Soviet Union would mean a nuclear war. And so he had no point. His only option was to be a great peacetime president. And how did you do that? You had to negotiate with the Soviets. You had to prove to them that you were as powerful as they were. The line, let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate. Only when our arms are sufficient without doubt can we be certain without doubt they will never be used. So this is how Kennedy had to, his path to greatness wasn't like Churchill or Roosevelt through a war. It was through ending the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. And what did he mean by, this is an important part of the address too, let every nation know whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear mm-hmm. any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe, in order to assure the survival and success of liberty, this much we pledge and more.
Yes, very extravagant pledge. I'll say two things about it. One is that it was very consciously a response to a very tough speech that Khrushchev had given 2 weeks before, urging wars of revolution, guerrilla wars in third world countries against colonial powers, and that communist cadres assume the control of these wars. And so this was specifically aimed at that Khrushchev speech. Kennedy was found the speech so important that he had copies put on the desks of all of his cabinet members the first day they showed up for work. The other thing I would say is that the rest of the speech goes on to be, as the newspapers of the time realized, an invitation to negotiation. And if you look at Kennedy's administration, well, for the next 1,000 days, he wasn't willing to pay any price or bear any burden, meet any hardship. The military, the Joint Chiefs, and his own advisors wanted him to send combat units to Laos, as Eisenhower had suggested. Instead, he negotiated the Laos neutrality. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Joint Chiefs and McGeorge Bundy, McNamara, they were all for bombing the sites. Kennedy was for the blockade, and if that hadn't worked, we now know he was going to go to the UN instead of taking military action. Same thing with Berlin, and the same thing in Vietnam. People remember how he increased the advisors in Vietnam, which he did, but what they don't realize is at the time he was getting incredibly strong pressure from the Pentagon and from the State Department to send in combat units up to 200,000 American troops. And on 5 or 6 different occasions, this was recommended to him, and he refused to do it. So it's much more accurate to look at the rest of the speech predicting what Kennedy would do. He did negotiate the first treaty limiting testing of nuclear weapons in the history of the Cold War, first treaty, and that was the limited test ban treaty.
We welcome phone calls. We're talking about two very important speeches we remember 50 years ago this week, one the farewell address from Dwight Eisenhower and one the inaugural address from John Kennedy. We have two guests with us, and feel free to, if you can, go back in time yourself, if you're old enough to do that, and remember what your thoughts were about the speeches, the importance of those speeches, why we remember them 50 years ago today. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Let us go to Casey from Port Wing, our first caller. Hi, Casey.
Good morning. How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Awesome, Bill. Great show, and I would like to ask these questions and give these statements to your distinguished guests. One, I will talk about General and President Eisenhower. What we need to remember about General Eisenhower, he was not a combat war veteran. He was always a general or a colonel's aide or secretary to staff. The most combat General Eisenhower ever saw was in the crushing of the Bonus Baby Marchers in 1929 and 1930, the World War One veterans, in Washington, D.C. They set up a homeless camp at Washington, D.C., and Douglas MacArthur and General Eisenhower crushed them, killed 31 World War One veterans in the process because the President of the United States, Hoover, said, clean it out. Excuse me, or it might have been even Roosevelt. But the big thing to remember about Douglas MacArthur's famous quote, when Eisenhower was made commander of all forces for Operation D-Day, MacArthur made this quote, Eisenhower was the greatest clerk I ever had. Okay? Now I will go to Lieutenant Kennedy, United States Navy.
All right, let's take one at a time. David, you want to respond?
Well, it was absolutely Herbert Hoover, not Franklin Roosevelt,
right,
who called out MacArthur to put down the Bonus Marchers, although he regretted that he felt MacArthur had gone too far on that. Eisenhower was, he rose quickly in the Army and was an aide to MacArthur. But he knew the military inside and out, nonetheless, and his wariness of the Pentagon brass, the way they tried to kind of cushion their budgets with wasteful projects that many of them knew full well were not for real military need, was quite real. Despite his administrative service, in fact, arguably that made him better suited in some ways to be on the lookout for these kinds of tricks that the Pentagon was playing.
And thanks very much for the call, Casey. I'm sorry, we have a lot of calls, and we want to hear some more sounds, so we'll move on. Karen from Rolling Stone, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Karen.
My husband and I were in college at the time, and I was a sophomore in college when these speeches were given. I remember both of them very, very well. My dad was a very strong Republican. He loved Eisenhower. My dad had fought in the Second World War. And just thought the world of Eisenhower. And I was not yet 21, so I couldn't vote. I remember that. And in our family, it was always I like Ike. But I was far away. My family lived in California. I was going to college in Minnesota. And I can still remember standing outside the cafeteria in our student center listening to John Kennedy's inaugural I bet there were 150 students in front of the television, the one television that was in the student center, and thinking, oh my, it was incredibly inspiring. I had been in eighth grade when Martin Luther King led the speaking about the Montgomery bus boycott and had seen him on television. And you know, there was so much stirring in the country right then for people who were young. And I really think that John Kennedy's speech had something to do with the beginning of my life as a Democrat.
Very interesting. Thanks for the call. It was an incredibly inspirational speech to many young people like Karen at the time, Thurston, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And, you know, I think it's important to go, when we talk about the inspiration, people will often mention the famous line, and so my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. But I think it's important to go back a sentence or two there, because the "and so" implies that this is connected to what Kennedy has just said. And what he has just said is he has told Americans that in the long history of the world, only a few generations are granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. And then he goes on to say, the energy, the faith, and the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it, and the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so he's saying to people, as individuals, listen, you can make a difference. Your faith, your devotion, your courage, what you do can light the world. I mean, this is very powerful stuff.
It is. You also include a listing of the people who were inspired by this. So many people went into public service, Donna Shalala, so many Peace Corps volunteers, people in the arts community who listened to this and showed up for the inaugural or wrote letters thanking you so much, very prominent poets and and writers who said, thank you for including us. This is, it touched many, many people in many ways.
Don't forget James Meredith, who after
Meredith, tell the story, please.
It was after the night that after Kennedy, the letter that James Meredith sent to the University of Mississippi asking for an application to enter the university was dated January 20th, 1961. And he'd written the letter after listening to Kennedy's inaugural speech.
Oh, my. That just goes to the soul. We're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 50 years today was John Kennedy's inaugural address. We're looking at that. 50 years ago on January 17 was Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address. So we have two momentous speeches that we're looking at and as we celebrate their 50th anniversary. And we're welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655.
In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Thurston Clark, historian, author, journalist.
My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
He's the author of Ask Not, the inauguration of John F. Kennedy and the speech that changed America, currently working on a book of the last 100 days of the Kennedy administration. David Greenberg, professor of history and journalism and media studies at Rutgers University, author of Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image, Calvin Coolidge, and Presidential Doodles. And he has written about the, you may want to go to this, Slate online, posted Friday, Beware the Military Industrial Complex, in which he says Eisenhower's farewell address has been completely misunderstood. We have a ton of phone calls coming in. 800-486-8655 is our number. Steve in Wauwatosa is next. Hi, Steve.
Hi. My question is mainly directed to Professor Greenberg. I did read the Slate article, and I was somewhat taken aback by it. I'm wondering what his thoughts are on the privatization of military operations that started, I think, back in the Clinton years and has continued. And I wonder if that adds a new dimension to Eisenhower's warning. And I'd just like his thoughts on that. I'll take my answer off.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Steve.
Sure. Well, I mean, the privatization of military operations has grown enormously. I mean, it went on, you know, it didn't begin under Clinton at all. It's gone on for a long time. But it certainly accelerated, and it's really a kind of mixed blessing. It really was conceived as a way of trying to keep down these bloated Pentagon budgets. You remember, especially in the Reagan years, there were all these scandals about how much we were paying for military hardware and so on. And so Clinton, with reinventing government, with the idea that we were going to get our government services at a more efficient cost, saw the need to do some privatizing. One unfortunate result of this has been that a lot of the private contractors operate without being answerable to the military or to the government in the same ways that we expect our armed forces to be responsible and answerable. Their contracts are often secret or classified. So there's no question that companies like Blackwater and so on, with their extensive military contracts, pose a real problem and challenge for our policymaking and how we conduct our military operations. But we got to realize the alternative of not having them is also problematic. So I think the call is on to a very real problem.
An email that's come in for you, David, a caller who can stay on the line. Is it true that Eisenhower initially wanted to call it the military-industrial congressional complex?
No, that's not true. That's a rumor or a notion that got started, 10 or 15 years ago. It's been repeated by a number of sources. There's a great new book out by James Ledbetter, who's a reporter with Reuters now, called Unwarranted Influences. And he has looked at all the documentation, and there's no written record of a military-industrial congressional complex, or some people say military-industrial scientific complex. There's some vague recollections that people made years after the fact, but there's no good reason to trust in those over the documentary record that we have. So that's a myth that's been perpetuated in recent years.
Mm-hmm. Thurston, tell me about the meeting between Kennedy and Eisenhower that took place 50 years ago today. They had coffee with each other. They rode to the inaugural together.
That's right. They at least spoke to each other, unlike Eisenhower and Truman 8 years before. Truman refused to speak to Eisenhower. He detested him so much. So at least they had a conversation. They talked about the Cornelius Ryan book about D-Day. The more memorable moment from that ride and that coffee happens in the other car, where Jackie is sitting with Mamie Eisenhower. And at one point, Mamie remarks, just look at Ike with that top hat on. He looks just like Paddy the Irishman.
Ooh.
And we don't know. Jackie, of course, related that later to her husband and Arthur Schlesinger. And we don't know whether Mamie was saying that on purpose or whether it was just an unconscious slight. She wasn't thinking very carefully. Of course, the two men had this meeting that we talked about 3 days earlier, in which Eisenhower told him that he was going to have to use troops in Laos, and this really infuriated Kennedy. After the meeting, he told Ken O'Donnell, there he was, Eisenhower sat, telling me to get ready to put ground forces into Asia, the thing he himself has been carefully avoiding for the last 8 years. So there was no love lost between Kennedy and Eisenhower, and that continued throughout the Kennedy's administration. Hmm. The relationship was cool.
Although we had his grandson on a couple of weeks ago, and he said that they grew to respect each other much more.
Yeah, I think maybe. my research in the last 100 days, I'm not entirely sure of that. Kennedy certainly felt... perhaps Kennedy felt a great rivalry with Eisenhower. Kennedy was so determined to be a great president, and he realized your presidents are most commonly, compared to their predecessors. And there was a poll that was done by Arthur Schlesinger's father, who was a historian that came out in 1962, ranking the presidents. Great historians ranked the presidents. And Kennedy was absolutely delighted Eisenhower was down in the kind of bottom 25% or something. He's come up since now. But then Kennedy became very depressed because he realized that Eisenhower was in Europe, and he was afraid that he wouldn't see the poll
New
York Times and wouldn't realize how low esteem he was held.
Oh.
And he goes back and forth with Arthur Schlesinger, who has it in his actually unpublished diaries. And finally, Schlesinger assures him that one of Eisenhower's friends is bound to send him the article. And then Kennedy is much happier when he...
Oh, that's kind of mean-spirited, isn't it?
Yes, of course it is. It's competitive. That's the Kennedys. They wanted to win at everything. They wanted to win at touch football, their sailing races. He wanted to be the best president.
We'll welcome more phone calls in one moment. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Another factor in maintaining balance involves the element of time. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
Dwight Eisenhower, part of his farewell address. We go to Tom in Wanakee next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Say, a question I sent on email earlier, but I figured I'd call in, was I have been curious as to whether President Eisenhower addressed the, as it's been termed, the industrial military complex prior to the last 3 days that he was in office, during his presidency or during his military career.
Hmm. David?
Yeah, I mean, he did actually. He didn't use that phrase, so you wouldn't find it in a search. But he did express concerns. Even when he first comes into office, he gives a speech. I think it's the American Society of Newspaper Editors. I may be mixing up a couple different speeches, where he really talks quite explicitly about how all our spending on the military apparatus can divert from other urgent social needs, schools and hospitals, and so on. So this was not out of nowhere for Eisenhower. It really stemmed from this kind of conservative, budget balancing vision of the American economy. He was very old school, never understood Keynesian economics, the economics of growth. That was, that was too newfangled for him. So a lot of the impetus for this speech was about balancing the budget and, these very kind of basic, traditional values that he'd been reared with.
Hmm. Why is it, as we look at domestic issues, and we talked about Kennedy's emphasis on foreign affairs and James Meredith being inspired to get a college application form hearing this speech, but there wasn't a lot. There was some talk of poverty. There wasn't a lot of talk about what was one of the great issues at the time, and that was civil rights.
Yes, there wasn't. And, in fact, Harris Wofford and Lewis Martin, who were two of Kennedy's advisors on civil rights, had to lobby to get him to add a word, for example, the word at home with around the world, the line that goes, "We're unwilling to witness the slow undoing of human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today, at home and around the world." And they gave him three or four options for adding kind of civil rights kind of phrases or things. And this was the kind of the least really the least he could do, and he did it. He added the at home, and he does talk about poverty. Very interestingly, he says this line: "If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich," which is an idea that we're still debating this now.
We sure are.
And actually, what it is, it's very close to, I don't know if Kennedy borrowed this or was influenced by Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson said, "Widespread poverty and concentrated wealth cannot long endure side by side in a democracy." The same kind of idea.
Mm. Let's go to Deb in Illinois. Hi, Deb.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Deb. Go right ahead.
I have to say, I was 7 years old and in second grade when Jack Kennedy ran for office and was elected, and on election day, the school that I went to, Catholic school, had my little Catholic uniform, and all the Catholics were for John Kennedy, and I asked my mom, who had worked for him in during the primary and his election campaign, if I could go and stand with a sign, and that was in the days when you could stand with a sign right at the polls, and so I did that during my lunch hour at school and then after school, and I have loved politics ever since. But the thing is, when we listened to the inaugural speech on television, and he got to that part, and so my fellow Americans ask not, my mom looked at her four daughters and said, You'll be hearing that for the rest of your life. That's still quotable. It sure is. So I've been a lifelong political activist, and that it started at age 7. So that's my comment.
Thank you, Deb. And that speech did inspire in that way, didn't it?
Yes, it did. The comment also that Deb made is very to the point, that people recognized the power of this speech within moments of hearing it. You know, it wasn't something that was later puffed up by the pundits or spin doctors. I mean, this was something that touched people immediately. And 50 years later, here we are talking about it.
Yes, 50 years later. Can you guys believe this? It's 50 years. It goes by. Thank you both so much. I hate to let you go. I don't want to stop the conversation. There's so much more to hear and talk about, but we have to go. Thank you so much, Thurston, for being with us. David, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thanks. It was great. Thurston Clark, historian, author, journalist, author of Ask Not, The Inauguration of John Kennedy and the Speech That Changed America. A fascinating look at all that went into making this speech, and that takes in everything. What was in Jack Kennedy's mind during that time, and what formulated his ideas during his lifetime, plus just fascinating things of what was going on that day and the parties and all of that. And we also thank David Greenberg, who has written in Slate, if you want to go to the January 14 posting on the military-industrial complex speech. David is a professor of history and journalism at Rutgers University and author of Nixon's Shadow. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for heavy production for this program, and thanks to Chrissy Pease as well for on-air production in downtown Milwaukee. Thanks for listening.